Let me run this by my lawyer is a really helpful phrase to have in your back pocket. LegalShield has been giving legal peace of mind for over 50 years. They connect you to a vetted law firm in your state for an affordable monthly fee. Want an experienced set of eyes on a contract fine print? Or you finally want to get that will done? LegalShield has a dedicated group of lawyers who have your back, no matter what the future brings. Sign up today at LegalShield.com/iHeart. PPLSI does not provide legal representation or advice. See a plan for complete terms.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Have a ton of questions about LASIK? You're not alone. That's why we created LASIK.com. One place where you can go to find every answer to every question on your mind. Like, how much does LASIK cost? How long does recovery take? How do I find a doctor? If you've been thinking about LASIK, go to LASIK.com now. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Oh, hi, hello, welcome. This is Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and I'm your host, Liv, here with more of the spookiest of spookies, Conversation Edition. Today I spoke with one of the biggest names in ancient spooky, Daniel Ogden. He is a professor at Exeter in the UK, and we actually spoke because I had one of his PhD students on the show, Ryan Denson, to talk about all things sea monsters. You must remember that one from earlier this year. It was great. So when he suggested I speak with Professor Ogden, I was eager, not least because I own like four of his books and used my favorite one, The Source Book of Magic and All Things Supernatural, not the official title, that's in the episode description, but I used it in so many of this month's episodes, let alone the past spooky seasons that I've done. So today we spoke about all things supernatural, werewolves and witches and dragons. We dived into it all, and I am obviously very excited for you all to listen. One note is that we did record this shortly after I spoke with Ryan about sea monsters, so we're talking like March. So it's been a while, just to explain a couple things mentioned, but obviously I had to hang on to this episode until October, because spooky. So sit back and enjoy all things spooky and supernatural. Conversations, Dragons, Witches, Werewolves, The Ancient Supernatural with Daniel Ogden. So I would love to hear about really anything when it comes to the supernatural world in the ancient world, particularly I think like werewolves and witchcraft and dragons as well. So, I mean, I'll guide the conversation, or I'm just happy to also have you talk. So what interests you in this side of the ancient world? Because I do think it's kind of unique and different from the more sort of the typical access points.
I think it's just me, really. You know, this is my kind of stuff. When I started my graduate work, my research, it was in a very sort of sober, serious area. My PhD was actually on illegitimacy in ancient Greece. That was the fashionable sort of social historical subject in the late 80s, the early 90s, you know, when I was doing it. And I enjoyed that work, but I guess it wasn't really me, you know. And what I mean, what I'd always loved since being a kid was horror, certain kinds of science fiction, but the things that I was particularly interested in was Hammer horror movies. Of course, I didn't get to see them until I was quite a bit older. But even from being a small child, I was fascinated by, you know, that those particular versions of Dracula and Frankenstein and the Mummy, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so that's it. So you know, I mean, the simple answer to this, to your question, is that I'm just looking for that kind of stuff in the ancient world.
I mean, and that's something that's very fascinating to me as well. I mean, I sort of just appreciate horror generally. My version of loving horror is a lot of like slasher movies from the 90s and weird things like that, supernatural. And so basically, as soon as I found out that I could talk about werewolves in the ancient world, it was like a very, very big thrill for me. So, I mean, I think, and I hope it's all right that I want to start with werewolves. I know you're most recently talking about dragons. But werewolves are so interesting because I just kind of, I guess I had no real grasp that the concept of that was so ancient. And like, why do you think that existed back then, this idea of being transformed into a wolf? As I mean, I'm not phrasing a question very well, but I basically just want to hear more about why you think werewolves happened in the ancient world.
Well, it is a good question, and I'm not sure I have a definitive answer.
Fair enough.
But I mean, it's often said that, wolves are often regarded as, in a sense, the antithesis to man, as man is the super civilized, the wolf is the super wild. I suppose, I mean, you could say that there are many animals that could be regarded as super wild. So why not talk about men turning into them instead, if you want to play with that polarity, you know, if you want to think about that polarity between wildness and civilization. They are, but I suppose, I mean, wolves being fairly big animals are sort of almost kind of man-sized somehow. You can sort of understand, as it were, the transition between the two. It's a bit harder to think of, the transition between a man and a stoat, for example, isn't it? You know, they're the right size. But as I've suggested in the werewolf book, I think it's actually not quite as simple as that. It's not just that wolves are super wild and, you know, humans are super civilized. Because if you think about it, and actually I think most people who are interested in wolves these days would think about it like this. In their own way, wolves are super civilized, aren't they? I mean, they have their own packs, their own communities, their own hierarchies. They're very cooperative, collaborative animals, and of course they're basically doggies, you know, and indeed, in the right circumstances, are rather friendly animals. So I think that's part of the mix too. That there is already that sort of bridge there between man and wolf, and again, as I say in the book, in a sense, a wolf is already in itself a werewolf, because it does have the wild aspect, but it also has the civilized man-like aspect, you know. So I think that's the reason of choice if you're thinking about what animals might a man turn into. Or what sort of problems might we think through, you know, with this sort of polarity between man and wolf? Again, I do think the wolf sort of particularly lends itself to that sort of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
That's my basic take. I think, in fairness, I should say that probably other people would probably give you other answers. I mean, one answer you might be given would be that it's all to do with social organisation, and that there's an ancient tradition, an ancient custom, a sort of international, almost universal, I think, custom of young bands of warriors being sort of conceptualized as wolf packs.
Interesting.
And so this is basically the origin of it, as it were, the young man becomes the wolf to be this sort of marauding warrior. And that's a phase he grows out of in due course. So you have the man turning into the wolf and then returning from the wolf to personhood, I suppose, manhood. Again, it's all, I mean, rites of transitions are in there somewhere. You know, the mm-hmm. idea that you go into, you temporarily visit an opposite status and then return from that opposite status to transition. So, I mean, a lot of people still believe that kind of stuff about mm-hmm. about werewolves, you know. I mean, there's something in it, mm-hmm. but I think we do have a bit of that in the ancient world, particularly in the case of Arcadia, it seems. Mm-hmm. But I think as far as the ancient world's concerned, the notion that young warriors are werewolves, that's a sort of metaphorical development from an already existing sort of folk belief in werewolves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's interesting to me specifically because I focus so much on mythology broadly. And there's so much transformation in mythology, but there's something so different about the idea of transformation when it comes to werewolves. You know, like, I mean, the gods are always transforming into animals to do various things, good and bad. But the idea of like humans transforming in this much more like explicitly wild kind of way, like when humans are, the idea of a human transforming into a werewolf, it's like them becoming something else entirely, versus the idea of a god transforming. And very much I think we're to assume that, you know, when Zeus transforms into a swan, he's still Zeus, he just looks like a swan. Whereas werewolves are so different, it's much more, it feels like a fear in the human psyche of becoming a monster, I guess.
Yes, although they're not necessarily quite as different as you would think. Yes, certain werewolf stories, entail that the man transformed into a wolf is a real wolf, or, you know, behaves like a wolf. And obviously you have that with the Petronius werewolf story, if you know that, where the soldier, having transformed, starts attacking the flocks that the Melissa keeps. And I suppose the werewolf latent in the Aesop story, again, who is potentially going to devour the innkeeper, is also of that sort. But then again, if you go back to the Arcadian material, again, the belief is that, again, these young men, having they transform into wolves for a fixed time, before they can recover their personhood, but there's this notion that if they abstain from human flesh within that time, the notion is that if they abstain from human flesh within that time, then they are able to transform back to being human again. So that, and I think the assumption is that in fact they all do. Okay. So that sort of builds a picture of a werewolf who's actually rather civilized werewolf. I mean, still a man inside, as it were, with some degree of human consciousness. And that sort of ties in very neatly with the earliest medieval werewolves. You know, so after about 400 BC, when Augustine is talking about werewolves, after that there's a kind of gap, you know, of 800 years or so, until we start hearing about werewolves again, and typically first in French and Norse sources, and in those in the French sources again, those werewolves are sort of unfortunate men transformed into wolves, but still retaining their human consciousness inside. So again, there's not much emphasis on that in the ancient sources, which are quite sparse, as I'm sure you realise. But I think, again, certain ones of them do entail the notion that the man transformed into the wolf is still a man and can behave, you know, in a fairly civilised way.
Mm-hmm. Well, that just makes it so much more interesting, like the idea that there are so many different variations on what it is actually like to be a werewolf in whatever way, that there are these, like, not options, but these alternatives where you're either monstrous or just a person in a wolf. It really adds to the fascination that the stories were really developed in the first place, that they have these all different types and you know, span so many different generations and, you know, and centuries and things.
Yes, I agree. There's no sort of one fixed pattern, even the ancient world. You know, I mean, each werewolf seems to, or each werewolf case seems to be a little bit different. You know, I agree.
I just love the idea of these things, you know, crossing time so much and just staying in the realm of imagination in all these different ways. Because even today you have stories of werewolves that are good or bad or a little bit in between. And
sure.
Just the idea that the story is that old is so exciting. Just the idea that the ancient world, while they were, you know, so involved in mythology and everything, but then had all these sort of separate and much more human ideas of transformation and generally, like, the supernatural, I suppose, in general, is really just broadly interesting to me. One of the other books of yours that I love to use, which I realize is probably like a different, I don't know how it goes writing these things, but the source book that you have on just generally magic and everything has been such a wealth of information for me, because just the idea that witches and witchcraft and magic and the supernatural broadly is utilized in so many different ways is really interesting. And again, I'm trying to find a question within that statement, but I suppose, you know, well, actually, you know what, one thing that really interested me, I spoke to somebody last year about this, is the differences between the ancient Greek ideas of witches and witchcraft and the Roman, because to me, this is speaking broadly, but they feel very distinct. You know, we have women like Circe and Medea, and then we have women like, I'm going to forget her name, but
Canidia, Erichtho,
yes, exactly.
They would be the obvious ones. Meroe,
yes.
Nephilus, they'd be the obvious ones to mention. Yeah.
Yeah. Canidia is who I was thinking of specifically, but all of those I've, you know, researched. This was a while back now, but they're such distinct types of characters. And it seems to me that the Greeks really found almost like a more positive interest in the idea of these kind of characters, whereas the Romans felt the need to make them like a bit more either ridiculous or dangerous or just, it's interesting the differences. Do you have thoughts on what that comes from?
Yes. I mean, well, I think actually Greek witches, evidence for Greek witches is really quite limited. It's mm-hmm. not much more than the traditions of Circe and Medea. And there's a whole bunch of people out there who don't think Circe is even a witch anyway. But I think the big difference in the end is that, yeah, Roman witches tend to be old hags and tend to be, well, I've used the word Gothic. It's a bit of a vague word, isn't it? Going back to my Hammer Horror days, really. they tend to have a sort of Gothic atmosphere. They're bloodthirsty. They're particularly bloodthirsty and involved with body horror and things like that, you know. But, you know, I mean, we shouldn't sort of let our eye leave the ball on this. I mean, the Greek witches can be pretty bad. I mean, let's not forget that Circe seemingly transforms all visitors to her island into animals. And, I mean, let's just think this one through. She turns, obviously, famously, Odysseus's crew into pigs and herds them into sties. Now, what's that about? What's that for? I mean, she's not just keeping them as pets, I think. You know, I mean, there's only one thing. Sheep you can keep for wool. Cows you can keep for milk. Chickens you can keep for eggs. There's only one purpose of a pig in a farm, and that's to be eaten. So she's planning to eat them, right? So that already makes, you know, we think of sexy Circe, but that already makes her look a whole lot worse, doesn't it? And we can go further than that. I think the indications are that every animal on the island is a human being that's been transformed. Mm-hmm. It's not immediately apparent when we first hear about the wolves and the wolves and lions that surround her house. But later on in the text, it does become clear that those also are transformed human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you think back again, before Odysseus has actually even seen, I think, Circe's house, or at least anyway, certainly approached it, he's found this big stag, which he's shot, and he's taken back to his crew at the beach, and they've eaten it. So mm-hmm. not only is Circe eating people, she's tricking perfectly innocent people into cannibalism. So, mm-hmm. you know, so she is pretty much a monster. And then to turn to Medea, I mean, let's not forget that Medea's first significant act really is to, after the Golden Fleece episode itself, her first significant act is actually to murder her own brother and chop him up into little bits.
Yeah.
And again, you know, sort of modern perspectives on the Medea play really, you know, have a lot to answer for. Even though she's murdering her children, she comes across as really sympathetic to us, doesn't she?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and she's, I mean, you would say that within ancient Greek myth, she's almost like a feminist icon. You know, I mean, she takes on a cheating husband and sorts him out, doesn't she? But one has to imagine, I think, that an ancient audience would have, certainly one has to be sympathetic to a certain extent to Medea in the play. There's mm-hmm. very little interest in it if one isn't sympathetic to her. But I think, you know, that child murder at the end has to figure rather large, more largely, you know, in the ancient imagination of her and the judgment of her mm-hmm. than it does for us. So they're pretty bad.
They are, but they're complex. That's what's so interesting about them is, like, they're bad, but they're bad has complexities. Because even Circe, like, she transforms all these people. The implication is to eat them, absolutely. But you can also see a way in which she's doing it as protection for herself and her island. You know, she sees these people as a threat. And while that's not a good way of necessarily handling a threat, you can see maybe where she's coming from. And I feel similarly with Medea, like less so about her brother, but with the children in Euripides, like Euripides really sets it up as though you can see her thought processes where she's like going through everything that has happened to her, all of her options as this woman who is not Greek, who is living in Corinth, and really has minimal options when Jason decides to leave her.
Sure.
Because she and her children will have nothing. They'll just be like thrown out. And so you can almost see that, again, like this is not, you know, a decision that we're meant to think is a good one, but you can see how she gets there, where she almost feels like it's a kindness to her children versus having them with her just like left out in the dust because of Jason. And so, like, in both cases, that's what interests me, where, you know, they do bad things, absolutely. There's no like redeeming their actual actions, but you can see where they're coming from. Whereas mm-hmm. with the Roman, and I'm not as familiar with the Roman, I'll admit, but they feel a lot more just like almost not necessarily comedically, but like over the top evil, sure. over the top bloody yeah. and gory and over and just like bizarre yeah. almost.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, there's a little, well, I was going to say there's little attempt to give Canidia much of a backstory or to make her sympathetic. Mm-hmm. Although, I mean, there's quite a lot of humour, I suppose, sardonic humour in one of Horace's poems about her, the one in which he claims to have been subject to her binding love magic.
Mm.
Erichtho too, Lucan's Erichtho, you know, this great sort of necromantic witch.
Mm-hmm.
Again, she's not completely one-dimensional. There are a couple of little touches in that, you know, as you would say, bizarrely over-the-top portrait that I like. One mm-hmm. is that when Sextus Pompey first seeks her out to perform a reanimation for him, or at least some sort of divination. It turns out to be a reanimation. He tells her that he's sought her out because he's heard that she's the best, and she's clearly flattered. She's clearly touched by that. So there's that little very human element to it. And then also when she's threatening the gods in order to get them to make the ghost re-inhabit the body so that she can reanimate the corpse, one of the threats that she makes is to expose the goddess Hecate before the other gods without her makeup on. That's what sort of a threat is that? I mean, it's all about the horrors of petty bourgeois, middle age, isn't it? I mean, it's humour, isn't it? Because it's just humour. It's there's lots of humour there. So again, Erikso is a complex figure. But I've recently argued again. This is probably quite an obscure book, so you may not. And it's just a little book. You may not have seen it. I've also recently published something called The Strix Witch. This is a little book, just about 30,000 words, on that phenomenon. And that phenomenon, to be brief, is a phenomenon of old women who transform themselves, who fly by night, either by transforming themselves into owls or by some sort of soul projection. And in either owl form or soul form, they penetrate a domestic house. There's usually some sort of issue as to how they get past the door, but that's the challenge. And they attack babies within, either stealing the baby or attacking the baby, stealing organs from the baby, sometimes surreptitiously stealing organs from the baby so you don't realize they're stolen, and then getting out again, leaving the baby to sort of, leaving the baby dead or to fail slowly. So that's quite a phenomenon, and we get of the classical authors, we get Ovid and Petronius talking about these witches, what they say is sort of nicely amplified by some medieval sources, which I won't go into. But that was a distinctive phenomenon in Roman culture. That was kind of like the Roman answer to the Greek child killing demon, the Lamia. The function of that sort of folk belief, sort of the Strix Witch, is clearly, I think, to account for, mass infant mortality. If every other child is going to die within a few weeks of being born, you need an explanation for it, don't you? But anyway, I think that idea, the notion of this Strix Witch, this quite distinctive phenomenon, is what imbues the portraits of witches in Latin literature, in the poetry and the prose, in Apuleius too. I think that is what sort of gets into the mix there, and that's why witches are all suddenly like old and bloodthirsty. I think they've all been strixified, even if they're not specifically designated as strixes on an individual basis.
That's really interesting. It sort of connects with what I had sort of thought of the Latin witches, that they also sound like a bit of a commentary on women and just the opinions of these writers and the culture on women broadly, because I mean, even just the idea of a threat of like revealing a goddess without makeup on doesn't seem like something that a woman would ever write. It very much feels like a man writing about a woman. And I find that very interesting. I think it says something about their like mindsets.
Possibly. I suppose it's a man recognizing a peculiarly feminine anxiety, I suppose. And blowing it up big, isn't it?
Let me run this by my lawyer is a really helpful phrase to have in your back pocket. Legal Shield has been giving legal peace of mind for over 50 years. They connect you to a vetted law firm in your state for an affordable monthly fee. Want an experienced set of eyes on a contract fine print? Or you finally want to get that will done? Legal Shield has a dedicated group of lawyers who have your back, no matter what the future brings. Sign up today at LegalShield.com/iHeart. PPLSI does not provide legal representation or advice. See a plan for complete terms.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Have a ton of questions about LASIK? You're not alone. That's why we created LASIK.com. One place where you can go to find every answer to every question on your mind. Like, how much does LASIK cost? How long does recovery take? How do I find a doctor? If you've been thinking about LASIK, go to LASIK.com now. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Yes, it's hard, to be fair, it's hard not to look at these Roman portraits of witches and not think of them as being misogynistic. Mm-hmm. But I think, and that's fair enough. I mean, I'm not going to recoil from that. But one point I would want to make is that this concept of the Strix witch in itself, which is influencing these portraits, I'm not sure that the concept of it in itself is misogynistic.
Hmm.
Even though you're painting a picture of a distinctively female monster, a kind of anti-mother monster.
Mm-hmm.
Again, what is the social function of believing in Strix witches or on the Greek side, in child-killing demons? I think it is to explain otherwise inexplicable infant mortality.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me, and if a Strix witch or a child killing demoness, Lamia, is not going to get the blame for a child dying, who is going to get the blame for a child dying?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it better to be blaming child killing demons and child killing witches than to be executing young mothers who've mm-hmm. just lost their babies?
Very true.
I think it's not quite as cut and dried as it thinks, as it seems.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes these sorts of belief can actually work in women's favour, and not always to their detriment. And indeed, I would say that, I mean, probably who thinks more about who in ancient society cares most, frets most, is most anxious about infant mortality? I would suggest it is the mothers, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
So probably these ideas of, say, Strix witches and child-killing demons probably originate, I would say, and sort of belong with women themselves in the first instance. Mm-hmm. So again, so I'm a bit reluctant to say in a sort of very reductive way, this is a misogynistic idea. Yes, it's an idea that we may well find being used misogynistically in our male authors.
That's the thing. It sounds like a little bit of everything. Because, I mean, certainly, I mean, even just the idea of if if babies are dying, if there is an issue with infant mortality and you have to explain it via a supernatural source, like, it seems obvious that that source would be feminine. That certainly, you know, just sort of fits the bill. But then I think it's similar, you know, you can have those ideas that are based in not misogynist ideas, that are just based in sort of like the more obvious choice, that then can get transformed into more misogynist ideals, like when it comes to the Latin authors who are sort of having a lot of fun with these characters and you know, inventing their own versions, certainly. But that's very interesting, the idea of the connection with Lamia as well, because I'm just constantly fascinated by the explanations that the ancient people had to account for tragedies and or just, you know, phenomena like babies dying, you know, unexpectedly, and the idea that the concept of a child killing demon or this witch, you know, is invented to sort of account for that is interesting and certainly refreshing, that it doesn't mean that immediately the mothers are going to be blamed for, you know, killing an heir or something.
Sure, exactly. Yeah.
It's fascinating to me that I guess, you know, witches in ancient Greece then didn't get the same designation. Like, they had these very distinct ideas. And Lamia too, like, you know, she doesn't appear in a lot of strict mythology, more of like the folk idea, like you're mentioning.
Yes.
Which has always interested me, because she's an interesting character, and sometimes she's one person and sometimes she's like a concept.
Sure.
Of these like demon characters. But I suppose the other thing that occurred to me as well is Circe and Medea, the most famous, if not the only Greek witches, are also explicitly divine in a way that the Roman witches seem much more, not necessarily mortal explicitly, but like down to earth, for lack of a better term.
Oh, sure. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to really scrape around for ordinary witches in the Greek world. I mean, mm-hmm. I suppose we have the historical example of Theoris, who was, a woman accused of witchcraft in classical Athens. And Lucian, mm-hmm. second century AD, going quite late now, Greek author, mm-hmm. does have some witches talking together, or rather some courtesans talking about a witch, I should say, they can use. Again, one might think they live in the same world to a certain extent. But yes, it's pretty hard. It's pretty hard. And of course, there's always the problem of Symaitha. You know, I mean, Symaitha. Mm. Again, many people, I think, would argue that Symaitha is not a witch, but she's surely pretending to be a witch very hard, isn't she?
I don't think I'm familiar with her.
Oh, you're not familiar with Symaitha? Oh, well, that's all.
No, or if I am, I've forgotten.
Right. Oh, well, yeah. So this is Theocritus's second idyll. So, you know, Hellenistic, Alexandrian literature. Oh. Around about 275 BC, something like that. It's a wonderful book. It's about 100 lines, is it, or so? A very elaborate monologue by this young woman. She is a young woman, mm-hmm. I think, who has acquired a boyfriend, Delphus. She said she was a virgin beforehand, but he's been with her for a few days or a few weeks, and he's suddenly disappeared. He's not coming around anymore. And with the help of her maid, so she's clearly not a completely destitute woman. I don't know what she seems to live on her own with her maid, but don't know what her source of income is. But mm-hmm. together they are concocting a very elaborate love spell to get him back.
Mm-hmm.
And we hear about all the details of this love spell as she speaks, and she's throwing everything at him. So all sorts of love magic. Of sorts that you would never find together in the same place. Usually, everything is thrown together in this kind of haphazard way. If a little is good, a lot is better principle. and it's again, in some ways, it seems as though she knows a lot. You know, she's, you know, she has a lot of expertise about love magic. You know, when you line up what she's doing with the Greek Magical Papyri and other literary texts. Well, possibly, but it's also possible that her knowledge is kind of superficial, and you know, she's just as it were, sort of play. You know, she's an amateur playing the game as best she can. But whatever she is, I mean, I think nonetheless, it's that poem is splendid evidence for witchcraft, you know, and ideas about witches, you know, whether Symaitha herself is actually a witch or not.
I realized as soon as you started describing it, it's been recommended to me, so it's on my list of two reads.
Right.
So I'm glad to have that description. Yeah,
it is in the source book, actually, so you don't need to go very far to look.
Oh, great. Perfect. That source book is so big. I've made my way through like certain chunks of it for episodes, but there's always more to get through. So one thing that that Ryan mentioned when we were speaking about sea monsters and the thrill of those is he was mentioning, you know, ideas of dragons and the connection to the real world. But I'm curious about just because dragons feel so separate, I suppose, from real life in a way that, you know, as we were discussing sea monsters, you can really see where they're getting the idea of sea monsters from just a lack of knowledge of what exists within the sea and what they can,
sure,
you know, discover about it. But dragons, you know, specifically like Apollo and Delphi, yeah, and that situation feels so separate. So I'm just curious about the connections between real things.
Yes, that is a good question. I think the first thing to say is that the ancient Greek word for dragon is drakon, and that goes into Latin as draco, and then I suppose English gets it through medieval French probably as dragon. But drakon didn't mean quite the same thing as dragon does to us. Drakon basically means a jolly big snake with, and well, this is my sort of, the definition that I've come to use for it over the years, a big snake and something more. And that something more is, well, usually there's a sort of supernatural dimensional context to it. Or sometimes the more can be much more sort of crudely physical, you know, an extra part. So, for example, many dracontes are portrayed on Greek vases with beards, human-style beards. For example, or they're often sort of compounded into with other animals to make, you know, make compound monsters of various sorts. Obviously, Cerberus has a dragon tail and dragon hair. People don't often realize that, and dragon hair.
I love his dragon mane, his little snakes in the mane.
Yes, exactly. Yes, and obviously, you know, Medusa has the dracontes on her head. The Chimera has this dracone tail. A dracone could just be a big snake, as I say, and the minimum sort of requirement is a kind of supernatural context. So the serpents of Asclepius, for example, were dracontes. There is evidence, you've got to work hard with it, but there is evidence for the maintenance of actual snakes. If your listeners are herpetologically minded, they were probably four-lined snakes, a variety of rat snake. There is evidence for them being maintained in temples, where they were used as Asclepius's temples and other healing temples, where they were used as part of the healing process, and you know, would be invited to lick or kiss the patients. Yes, it affects different people in different ways, doesn't it? I quite like it myself, I think. But I mean, four-line snakes are harmless, and actually, I think friendly would be the wrong word, but I've seen them described as phlegmatic. They don't mind humans mauling them, you know. So, but anyway, there is a sense in which, you know, dracontes, some kinds of dracontes, were real animals, very much part of not necessarily everyday life, but part of real life, you know. And so it's really just a matter of, you know, just imagining how far the Dracone that you know, I won't say in love, but the Dracone that you know, how far that idea can be stretched, you know, what other varieties of it might there be, have there been, you know. So, yeah. And in terms of like sort of more monstrous, fantastical creatures, I mean, Dracontes and others. Again, one of the I'm sure that this must be a big book for you as it is for me. Adrian Mayor's First Fossil Hunters. In fact, I have to say, if you're looking for recommendations to come on your podcast, I would put her number one.
And she's on my list.
That is, I mean, a splendid, fascinating book, and she's a splendid communicator as well. One of the amazing things that I learned from that book is that I'm trying to think of the word. I want to say primeval, but that's a bit of a broad word. Let's just say prehistoric megafauna fossils. I'm sure there's a better word than that, but anyway, were found in the archaeological remains of the Temple of Hera on Samos, the great Temple of Hera on Samos. You know, I'm not sure whether it was specifically one of these mega giraffes that used to exist, but anyway, something like that. So anyway, so the bones of a massive, strange creature. And you've got to ask, how did they get there? You know, so clearly, some ancient Greek at some point dug these out of a hillside somewhere or found them lying around and, you know, said, well, these are the bones of something pretty amazing, pretty special. And, you know, all sorts of stories could be spun around it. So I'm sure on some occasions, bones like this were the bones of great Dracontes from the past. On other occasions, they would be identified as human bones, I suppose. Again, we hear about, as you're probably aware, we hear all sorts of stories about the discovery of the bones of heroes, and heroes were imagined to be supersized, so that works, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then given special treatment. But what is going on in your mind if you're living in the ancient world and you don't have it, you're not a Darwinian. You know, you don't have a concept of the historical dimension of these creatures. You know, for you, the Earth is pretty much always going to have been as it is now. So how do these creatures fit into it? There you are. I mean, there is your proof. There is your incontrovertible evidence that monsters of the sort that you hear about in myth did exist. If they don't exist now, they did exist. You know, So I don't think it's too hard, really. It was too hard for the ancient Greeks to make these Dracontes real for themselves.
Right. I love the idea of finding some kind of bones and then coming up with the idea for the chimera, because it's one of my favorite creatures. It's just so bizarre.
Right.
And certainly it could have also just been imagination based on other things that they'd found. But I just like the idea of them finding some bones and being like, well, I think this is a lion, but maybe there's also a goat's head and a snake involved.
Yeah. I mean, the goat is the tricky part, isn't it? Of course, it's...
Yeah.
I mean, in a sense, the goat is the indispensable part because chimera means goat. So it's almost like it started with the goat, and the other bits of it, which look more useful, like the lion and the snake, there may be the optional extras. But I mean, again, of course, I'm always promoting and urging the importance of Dracontes. But I do think, I mean, having mentioned the chimera, I do think the dragon, although it's just a tiny bit, it's just a tail, as with Cerberus. Mm. Although it's only a tiny sort of proportion of the monster, in many ways it's the most important part, and it's kind of like the business end. Because why is the chimera terrible? Because it goes around burning everywhere up. It's a fire-breathing monster. It goes around laying waste to landscapes. how does it have the capacity to breathe fire? Well, that has to come. Even if it's breathing fire out of its lion mouth, not its snake mouth, that ability has to come from the snake element, it seems to me, because again, the notion that I should have started somewhere else here, the notion that ancient dragons breathed fire, and that's very, very firmly established already in the ancient world, that is clearly, in an ancient context, an imaginative extrapolation of viper venom, you know, which induces a burning sensation. I don't doubt at all that's why dragons breathe fire, because they're like big vipers. And so the Chimaira, to go back to the Chimaira, breathes fire because it has that snake tail. Mm-hmm. Kerberos, similarly, I would say, I mean, again, one of the lesser myths of Kerberos, but my personal favourite, is that when Heracles dragged him out of the underworld, bear in mind he'd been born in the underworld, he'd never seen daylight before. So, big tough dog as he was terrified. And what does a terrified dog do? He threw up. And he threw up on a harmless plant called the aconite, and his vomit or his slather transformed that plant into supposedly the most poisonous plant of the ancient world, the aconite. Again, so where is that venomousness coming from? Again, it has to be not his doggy element, but his snake element. Mm-hmm. And then if we go to Medusa again, what is her sort of, you know, USP, her characteristic, you know, weapon? Of course, as you know, it's freezing people, isn't it, into stone. Mm-hmm. And it's not true, apparently, but there is this widespread folk belief, very, very widespread international folk belief, that snakes hypnotize their prey before eating them and freeze their prey. Right. I mean, I think it's probably often the case that a rabbit seeing a snake just does in fact freeze as a sort of defense mechanism to avoid being seen, especially snakes sort of see movement more easily than, you know, fixed things. But anyway, there is that belief, and it seems to me that the reason that Medusa and the Gorgons can freeze people into stone is because that's another snake capacity that's been you know, built up, magnified and built up. So although snakes are a sort of relatively small proportion of these three monsters, as I say, I think they're the key bit, really. They're the things that give them their killer qualities, you know.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I wonder too about like paralytical qualities of snake venom. I don't know enough, but it seems to me that that could be connected to Medusa as well.
Oh yes, that's a good point. Yes, because snake venom, I think yes, it can paralyze, can't it too? So yeah, so that may well be part of the story. Yes, indeed. Yes.
Yeah. Interesting. I'm curious about the myths that involve the planting of the teeth afterwards.
Sure.
And I know that comes from like autochthony and just, you know, being born of the earth, but in terms of the snake value, is there anything there?
I don't know if there's anything distinctively snaky about that. Mm-hmm. It is weird, isn't it, that we get this this motif in two different places. We both get it in Thebes when Cadmus has killed the dragon of Ares, and then we get it again over in Colchis.
They're two very different examples. Like, they're one's like growing the new Thebans to help Cadmus, and then one is like the people that Jason has to fight. So I find that interesting as well, that they're very distinct in terms of like the function of the people that grow.
Well, yeah, I mean, well, again, they're both warriors. They're both bunches of warriors, aren't they? Mm-hmm. And actually, Cadmus does have to deal with the Theban spot-sown men. He has to throw this stone in amongst them so that they start fighting themselves. I mean, I suppose the notion is that they can fight him otherwise. So maybe it's not quite so different. But we are told actually that when Athene gathered up the teeth for Cadmus to sew, gathered the teeth out of the jaws of the dragon of Ares, she kept half of them back and gave them to Aeetes. So those stone warriors over in Colchis they come from the same place.
I forgot about that.
I'll say something more about No. I'll talk about Thebes first.
Great.
One thing that interests me about that particular story is that there are different traditions about Cadmus. Cadmus is attributed with discovering or inventing a lot of different things, including alphabets. Mm-hmm. He's also credited with the discovery of metal and the invention of mining. Mm. Now, think about that in connection with two facts. Normally, he is said to have killed the dragon with a stone. Mm. And then, of course, the stone men famously grow out of the ground already wearing arms. Mm-hmm. And I can't help feeling that is another way of telling the story of Cadmus's discovery of metal. He kills the snake with a stone because metal doesn't yet exist. But then the teeth are sewn, the warriors spring up, and there they are wearing armor. There is metal coming out of the ground. Mm-hmm. So somehow that metal comes from the body of the dragon, which is interesting. Again, one tends to think about the metallicness of snake skin then. But then going over to Colchis, it is weird. It is weird that why should half of these teeth be held back and then given to Eetes? It just doesn't really make sense. The order of things as we have it, as I recall, in Apollonius' Argonautica is, so for the first trial that Jason has with Eetes is to sew the teeth. It's to yoke the fiery bulls, which he then uses to sew the teeth, the snake's teeth, dragon's teeth into the ground. Then the armed men grow up, and then he has to fight the armed men. Then he goes on to deal with the dragon, another dragon that guards the golden fleece. Now, I have to say, it would make much more sense, wouldn't it, within the Colchis story, if he dealt with the dragon first, and then those armed men derived not from the teeth of some strange Theban dragon all the way over there, but from the teeth of the Colchis dragon. I must admit, I'm very tempted to believe that there was this thing, the mythical lost version of the story, which I was talking about. Mm-hmm. There was a lost version of that story in which the episodes happened in a different order. So dragon first, and Jason would have had to kill it, I suppose, rather than it just being sort of drugged by Medea. And then the teeth come from the dragon and are then sewn. And at that point, Jason has to fight the armed warriors, which is exactly actually what happens in the 1963 movie, Jason and the Argonauts. Mm-hmm. Again, Ray Harryhausen changes that all around and to give it a much better logic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And those great skeleton men.
Exactly. I mean, yes. Again,
it's
important to, yes, it is important. I'm afraid rather soberly and disappointingly to remind your listeners that those skeletons, they belong to Ray Harryhausen, and that the original sewn men are just, I'm afraid, rather boring, ordinary men.
I know. It's too bad because the skeletons are incredible. That's really interesting. Because there's also, we have that pottery of Jason like being spit out of the dragon too, right? So it certainly seems to suggest there's a different tradition there, especially because Apollonius is writing so late, and we know that the general idea of the story of the Argonautica and the quest and everything is much older, but most of the details we have are from the Hellenistic period. So,
well, I agree. Yes, I mean, for me, one of the big mysteries, actually, of ancient Greek literature and myth is, where was the original Argonautica? Where did that brilliant, brilliant story, where was it originally kept? There are suggestions about sort of obscure lost epics like the Epic of Naupactus, of which maybe eight words, I forget exactly how many, it's like eight words survive. you know, strange suggestions like this. But it is a mystery. It really is a mystery where that myth was sort of kept and cherished before it actually mm-hmm. ended up in Apollonius. Oh gosh, no, I was going to say something else. What was that? No. Oh yes, sorry. Yes, you mentioned that wonderful the Duris cup with Jason. Yeah. Being thrown up again. Here we come to dragons throwing things up. It's becoming a theme, isn't it? So being thrown up by the by the dragon, and that's an episode which just simply does not appear at all in the literature.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I do have a theory about what's going on there. Why should the dragon have to throw Jason up? Mm-hmm. Obviously, he's going to be thrown up. He's going to live again, and he's going to get the fleece. Mm-hmm. So you know, obviously, at one stage it was looking very good for the dragon. Well, again, I come back to Apollonius of Rhodes, and yet again, I was going to say I want to rearrange his episodes. In fact, I don't need to rearrange his episodes. Mm. But one of the episodes in that, so before Jason faces the fiery balls and the armed warriors, one of the very distinctive, memorable episodes in that is that Medea smears him all over with an invincibility mm-hmm. lotion to protect him. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that actually that may be the key to what's going on with the dragon spitting him out. I think maybe he is imbued with this invincibility lotion at this point too, or still, and so the dragon can't digest him. So even though it succeeds in swallowing mm-hmm. him, it has to throw him up again. And as I say, he lives to fight another day. That's my mm-hmm. that's my theory about what's going on there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that I mean, given Jason is helped by Medea in very important and vital ways throughout, that certainly makes sense that it would be another one of her actions that you know helps him get out of the dragon.
Exactly, yes.
In whatever way, because yeah, he does very little without her help. Yeah. In the Argonautica.
Yeah. Yes, he's always being sidelined. And if you look at the late antique Orphic Argonautica, he's completely sidelined because Orpheus becomes the star of that, and mm-hmm. Medea still has something to do. But Jason, he really is a third wheel. He's just hanging around doing not much. Yeah,
he's interesting for that. Cadmus is one of my favorites, and I'm realizing now it's been a really long time since I've actually like talked about him much on the podcast because there's not a lot of like long-winded evidence for his stories or surviving pieces, but I find him so fascinating because he was such an important hero. Like in terms of, you know, as you were saying, he brought the alphabet mythologically and metal, which I wasn't aware of. And I love that connection between the stone and the stone men growing up with full armor on. But I'm just curious about, I suppose this isn't a question so much as I just am interested in Cadmus and always curious for more. But I wonder if you just have any thoughts on him as a character, given he does have these important aspects, but is lacking much in the way of any, like, you know, long epic story like the rest of the more famous heroes.
Well, not really, I'm afraid.
It was a stretch. We're not talking about him.
I'm sure there would have been an awful lot of themes in the epic cycle. Yes, I mean, we do have an awful lot of sort of quite meaty Theban mythology still, don't we? Especially mm-hmm. in tragedies. But you're right. Yes, Cadmus is a bit of a hole in that.
Well, and even from what I've heard about the like missing Theban cycle, is it does still seem to be more revolving around the Oedipus and the Seven Against Thebes bit. Sure. So all people who descended from Cadmus, but even still, it seems like in the lost works that we know are lost, you know, versus everything else, it still seems that he might be this kind of like missing character. And I just find him so fascinating for that, I guess, just because he does have really important things attached to him, but without any real story that we know of as either surviving or being missing. Just like to theorize on Cadmus personally.
Well, what we don't have is a, as you say, is a sort of meaty recreation, you know, so we don't have a, you know, a Homeric account of Cadmus. We don't have Cadmus in tragedy. We don't even have a,
he's in Bacchae.
Yes. Briefly, and actually there's quite an interesting reference to him there. And obviously we get a bit of Ovid, a nice bit of Ovid about him.
And Nonus is sort of the big one, but he's writing so late.
Indeed, yes.
Nonus is Dionysiaca.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, you're a brave person if you can get through Nonus.
I've read all the Cadmus bits of that, right, and it's mind-blowing.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. Yes, but you're right. He doesn't really come across as a personality somehow, does he? But he is interesting. Not the least interesting fact about him is his end, isn't it? How he ends up being transformed into a dragon alongside Harmonia. You know, and one wonders why that is. What's that all about? That
particularly because his family is so cursed as well. So his family is so cursed, and then they're turned into snakes, so they're almost not cursed. Is just a something I find quite interesting.
Yeah. I mean, part it might be that he has to make further compensation for killing the dragon, as it were, by sort of becoming a dragon in its place. But then you have to wonder about Harmonia. Why does Harmonia have to change too? You know, and what happened between? I mean, how is it that Cadmus could kill Ares' son, the dragon, but then gets to marry Ares' daughter, Harmonia? What's going on there? The psychology I'd like to see in all this is actually Ares' psychology.
That's something I wonder about a lot generally. Yeah. Ares is interesting. Well, and Harmonia is the reason I developed an interest in Cadmus, because I find her so fascinating. She's basically the only goddess who is, you know, a goddess on both sides. Both her parents are incredibly important, like both Olympians, and yet she lives her whole life as a mortal with Cadmus. And I just think there must be some kind of reasoning there that we don't have, some kind of background, because that's fascinating to me.
Yeah. Yes, I hadn't thought of that. But sure, And again, that sort of almost sort of intensifies the question as to why she has to end up as a dragon, doesn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, like why is she not immortal? There's never an explanation for why she would be living as a mortal and be able to, you know, that she doesn't get, you know, apotheosized like Heracles or anyone else, given that she is like, she's equivalent to Eros in terms of parentage.
Sure.
But then she has this whole mortal story and... Mm. Yeah, she and Cadmus are my passion project. So I'm just constantly looking for more about them. This has been so incredibly fascinating. I mean, I'm thrilled to have learned so much about these witches and werewolves and dragons and snakes and also Cadmus. So thank you for indulging me on my Cadmus and Harmonia talk. I really appreciate you speaking with me today. Right. Thank you so much. Is there anything you'd like to share with my listeners in terms of you know, your books or your work at all?
Yes, it'll be a long time before I produce another book, I'm afraid. I mean, I'm at the bottom of a sort of productive valley at this point. I may or may not at some point in the distant future, produce a sort of general guide to classical mythology, much as you have done yourself. My most recent proudest productions are the werewolf book, which you've mentioned, and then also there's what we call the new dragon book, Dragon 3, as I call it, The Dragon in the West. So those are the two books I'd want to advertise at this point.
Wonderful. Well, I'll put them in the episode's description, and I plan to air our conversation in around October, when I love to do all of the spooky stuff, and so I will be using all of your books again, and my listeners can learn more about them that way, and I'll share where to purchase them and everything, because your books have been incredibly helpful to me in all my spooky season episodes. Yeah. So thank you for
that's
that.
Very kind. Thank you.
I'm thrilled to have you. Thank you so much for doing this.
Great, it's been a pleasure.
Oh, nerds, nerds, nerds. Thank you, as always, for listening. I fucking love spooky season. It is just so much fun to trawl all the ancient sources and characters for anything that I can even remotely relate to this topic. It's like a treasure hunt every year. And I've been using Daniel Ogden's books for that treasure hunt for years now, so it was lovely to actually speak with him and learn about all these things even more directly. Especially that I got to talk about my new fascination, the vast difference between Greek witches and Roman witches. Those Roman witches, man, they were really something else. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is written and produced by me, Liv Albert. Michaela Smith is the Hermes to my Olympians and handles so many podcast-related things, from running the YouTube to creating promotional images and videos to editing and research. Stephanie Foley works to transcribe the podcast for YouTube captions and accessibility. The podcast is hosted and monetized by Acast. Help me continue bringing you the world of Greek myth and the ancient Mediterranean by becoming a patron, where you'll get bonus episodes and more. Visit patreon.com/mythsbaby or click the link in this episode's description. As always, you all are the absolute best, and I wouldn't be here without you. Thank you for listening. This coming Tuesday, the underworld, chthonic cuties. I am Liv, and I love this shit quite a bit.
Let me run this by my lawyer is a really helpful phrase to have in your back pocket. LegalShield has been giving legal peace of mind for over 50 years. They connect you to a vetted law firm in your state for an affordable monthly fee. Want an experienced set of eyes on a contract fine print? Or you finally want to get that will done? LegalShield has a dedicated group of lawyers who have your back, no matter what the future brings. Sign up today at LegalShield.com/iHeart. PPLSI does not provide legal representation or advice. See a plan for complete terms.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Have you been thinking about LASIK but not sure if you're a candidate? Just go to LASIK.com/quiz and take our free candidacy quiz. In just a few minutes, you'll know if LASIK is likely right for you. And if it is, we'll connect you with experienced LASIK doctors in your area. Start your journey towards 20/20 vision. Take our free candidacy quiz at LASIK.com/quiz. Yeah, LASIK.com. Easy to remember, so you know where to start.
LASIK, LASIK.com.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire. With the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.